go. The resentment train.
That's the resentment train. I've been on that train. All right, we've been waiting for you. All right, South Beach, let's get a seat. Mike and Mike are here. We can start the meeting. Let's invite God into his meeting. Father God, we thank you for the energy inside this room tonight, and we thank you for places like this, during holidays like this, where we can come and we know we're safe. Lord, we thank you for the 12 steps, for friends, for fellowship, and for fun. But we're also thankful for the seriousness of this disease. And Lord, as you know that we've lost people this very week to suicide and to overdoses, we pray that we take this meeting as serious as if it was our last. Help us to remember not to be serious about ourselves, but about our recovery. We thank you for the 12-step house, all that it represents, the program of recovery. We ask you to keep our minds open, our ears open, and help us to keep alert. We pray all these things in your name. Amen. Amen. Hi, everybody. My name is Stevie B. I'm a grateful believer and a recovering alcoholic and a proud member of the West Side Men's Group.
Nice!
And it's so good to be here with you guys tonight. And Merry Christmas to everybody. Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas. And happy holidays to Ben and all my other friends. Happy holidays. Hanukkah's passed. But I'll get you next year. It's great to be here with you guys tonight. We're on step 3. So if you haven't been coming here the last 2 weeks, I want to tell you that the way that I'm doing the steps this time is I'm doing a running story of my life as it correlates to the steps. So it's going to seem a little bit bizarre if you think that I'm just starting tonight because I'm actually leaving off where we left off last week. And I feel very humbled tonight. I really do. My wife was... She hasn't been here the last 2 weeks. I've never done a step series without her being almost in every meeting. And the last 2 weeks, she was practicing dancing. She's a performer for God. She dances for our church. And I really wasn't all that excited about her dancing for church during the holidays, because we have a retail business. You know how that is, Laura. And I'm thinking, it's not a great time to be dancing for God during the holidays, because we have a retail store. You know, we sell photo gifts. Dancing for God, keychains. It was like right up there. So keychains seemed to be weighing out dancing for God, and I really hadn't been in her corner. I was begrudgingly, when she would leave every morning to go practice, as a good husband would do, I didn't tell her I wasn't happy about it, that I would keep it silent. And tonight, we went over to this free event that they have at the church that we've never had before, and I really wasn't expecting much. I didn't know if it was going to be like a play for school and maybe she'd be holding up leaves. I didn't exactly know what she'd be doing. And to see the hand of God awaken in my wife's dance was something that I was so in awe of what he has done in her life and in my life. I was so in awe to watch her fly through the air and to dance for someone other than herself to countless hours. It's a ministry of volunteers. I was sitting there with Ann and some of my other friends, and to watch my wife just fly through the air and to have joy in her heart, not caring who was there to watch, but only that she was performing for an audience of one. And I got to tell you, for a guy that's, thinks he's a tough guy, James, I think I'm a tough guy from New York. Tears were coming down my face. And it was like the scales fell off my eyes. And I realized not only how I've been short-sighted and selfish and self-seeking, but that there's so much bigger things out there that unless we take time to watch and look and have an open mind about, we're going to miss it all. We're so, let me rephrase it, I'm so sometimes interested in the destination, I completely forget about the journey. And Marty has this great quote, and it has something to do with something, but messes up, no, I can't say it.
Okay.
That the destination messes up our process of the journey. It's like that. And it's true. I'm so ready for the finish line sometimes that I forget that all the miracles are happening in the journey. Yeah, it's great to have 19 years and 31 years and 40 and 39 years. That's fantastic. But it's also great to have 8 years. It's also great to have 8 days. Because this is our journey. My journey took exactly what it took to get to this place in my life. I thought that at 6 years that, you know, I looked around at my sobriety and I said to myself these very words, is this all there is? My first time around. I looked at my wife, same beautiful wife that I have today, 12 years ago. I looked at my house, same house that I have today. Looked at my parents, same job, same everything. And I looked around with those type of eyes, the type of eyes that is always looking at half a glass empty, and I said, at 6 years of sobriety, is this all there is? And God answered, yeah, with that attitude, yes, that's all there is. You're going to have exactly that. Yeah, with that attitude, that's what you're going to get. And so as he always does, he allows me and everyone else in here to go to a place where hopefully, before we break our backs, we bend our knees. And what I mean by that is that we get humble enough to open up our ears and hear his voice and not ours. Because if the only voice that you're hearing is your own voice, there's so much more out there. And so tonight, when I was watching her perform, and I was able to not hear my own voice, and the reason I know that is because God wasn't speaking in a New York accent tonight. He actually had your accent. And I knew that it was that still, quiet voice saying, you see, honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And these are indispensable. Indispensable means the most important. Can't do without. If you don't have open-mindedness, you can be sober, you can stay clean forever, you can be one of those people where they look like pirates, they're, you know, 50 years sober, singleness of purpose, aye. Or you can be walking around happy, joyous, and free. And people want to be around you. And they want to go to meetings with you. And they, what are you doing on Friday? What are you doing on Thursday? What are you doing on Wednesday? Joe, see, right up here. And you walk around with that light. And I look around this room and I see a lot of lights. I see a lot of people that a lot of people want to be around. Because it seems like most of us in here have figured out that just staying sober, although a blessing, and although fantastic, and although we can't do anything else without that, without everything else, is just staying sober. And are we going to have those days where sometimes we're going to, the days are going to stink, and we're going to have at the end of the day, well, at least I'm sober. Yeah, you're going to have those days, but if that's your month, if that's your 6 months, if you're walking around and you say, hey, how you doing? And you're like, hanging in there. And that was the same answer you had in December that you had in November of last year. Hanging in there. He wants us to have so much more than hanging in there.
Amen.
I mean, looking around the room right now, I know that there's the majority of people in here agree with me. Because most of us are happy, joyous, and free. And not all the time. This is not going to be a program of perfection. But we can shoot for perfection. You know, one thing that I say in a lot of meetings, and I'm sure you've heard it before, is why shoot for mediocrity when you know you're going to fall short? If you shoot for mediocrity, you're always at the low end. If you shoot for perfection, you're always going to fall short. And at least you're landing in that area. A lot of us, we're going through the day and like, well, at least I'm gonna do a lot of pillaging and I'm not gonna be honest in any of my affairs, but at least I'm staying sober. I'm not gonna practice these principles in any of my affairs, but at least I'm staying sober. And as Russell always says, and they'll give you medallions. You'll come up here and you'll bring yourself all the way up and you'll slither up the stairs and you'll come up to the podium and it'll be a mess and you'll pick up your 22-year medallion and people will clap. But that's not all there is. There's a man in here tonight. no, I can't even say it. But there's a man in here tonight who I love and respect and who's moving back to New Jersey. And his name is Doug, and he's a member of our home group. Did I tell you I was a member of the West Side Men's Group?
Nice!
I remember that, so I did say that. And anyway, he's a member. That's a resentment train. Doo-doo, who wants to be on it? He's a member of our home group, and this is technically his last step meeting with us. And we've been doing this journey for coming up on almost 4 years. And he's one of those guys, and everybody on this side of the room that knows Doug, and everybody on that side of the room that knows Doug will say the same thing. Right, Robert? He's just an amazing guy.
Yes.
He's a guy that you can count on. He's a guy that you say to him, can you save two chairs at the meeting on Tuesday, and he'll show up an hour early to make sure those two chairs are saved. He's a guy that if you call him and you say, can you pick me up at the airport? Absolutely. Can you watch my house? Absolutely. Would you go in and speak for me over at Bark on Christmas? Absolutely. And he's one of those guys that understands how it is to be happy, joyous, and free. But I want to tell you, when I first met him, it wasn't like that. It wasn't like that. He wasn't happy, joyous, and free. He was messy. He was messy, and he didn't look like he was going to make it, and he looked thin-skinned. How do you look thin-skinned? I mean, he just looked like he was about to blow away at any time. He looked like that if you yelled at him or said something that maybe he would be gone. He looked to me opinionated. He looked to me like a guy that wasn't going to be able to make this thing. And as God does, as he always does with us, the ones that make it, you know, you hear in the program people say, I don't know why I made it. Well, I don't know anything about that type of rhetoric. But I think the people that make it are the ones that surrender to His will. I don't think it's some type of roulette thing like Marty makes it and Ernie Richardson makes it and Doug makes it, but this side of the room doesn't make it because they're not blessed. I have a feeling that since we're all God's children, I have a feeling that He all wants to see us make it. I don't think he has a favorite room and a not favorite room. Because if there was a not favorite room, I wouldn't be making it. It wasn't like I was great before I came in. I'm not so great today. So you can imagine how I was when I was out there. So if he wants us all to make it, why is it some people that can't make it? There's some people right now, one of my closest friends in the whole world, can't stop using. Why is it that he can't stop using and I can? Because I surrender to God's will. So that's what the third step is all about tonight. Making a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. And what does that mean? We talk about it in a lot of meetings and people throw it out there and they say, I'm surrendering to God's will. But what does that mean? What does that mean if maybe you don't even believe in God? Or if you believe in God, you might not know who God is. Is that important? Let me throw that question. Is it important to know who God is in order to surrender to Him? And I want to tell you that it's not. Because anybody in here that claims that they know who God is, that's a very small God. If I can describe all of God, it's a very small God. If I could describe a piece of God, well, at least a piece of God, like if I could say God is love, we can all relate to that, can't we? But if I start telling you all the attributes and everything that He can do, then I limit what God can do in my life. And I don't want to ever do that. Because 9 years ago, when I hit the rock bottomest of my rock bottom in my life, if you would have told me that 9 years later I'd be doing the steps here, or that I'd been involved in a church, or that my wife would have retaken back the divorce papers that she served me with, and the restraining order would have been lifted, and that I would actually be able to leave a halfway house, and actually pay for my own way, sort of. I like to say sort of. My parents are here, my wife's here, you know, that I get a lot of help. I'm self-supporting through most of my contributions. If I would have told you that back then, it would have sounded like storytelling. But when I called up my sponsor and he started to give me the routine of me getting on my knees in the morning and getting on my knees at night, as I shared with you guys last week. Were you guys here last week for that?
Yeah.
Well, if you weren't, that was a turning point in my sobriety. I mean, it wasn't like I was, you know, sober a long time. It was 30 days sober, and he told me that I needed to start getting on my knees in the morning and getting on my knees at night and asking God in the morning and thanking him at night. And I said, I don't really have a firm consciousness on who God is. And he said to me, it doesn't really matter who you think God is. God already knows who you are. And I said, Jerry, I'm not even sure if I believe in God. He says, it doesn't matter because God believes in you. And he started every time I came up with an idea. But Jerry, I'm Catholic and we don't pray on our knees outside of church. And I knew he was Jewish and I knew that he might not know that rule. And he said to me, listen, Stevie, I don't understand what type of nonsense you're trying to pull over here. But if you want to stay sober and you don't want to die, you better just throw that religion stuff out and you better get on your knees and you better beg whatever God is of your understanding that you're going to stay clean and sober. And you know what? Let me tell you something. I didn't want to get high anymore and I didn't want to drink anymore. And I was a slave to alcohol. A slave. You know what that means when you're a slave to something? That means when that thing calls, you better run. That means every morning I would wake up and it would say to me, I would say to the alcohol, I'm not going to drink you today. And by the end of the day, I was drinking. That means every time that I pulled my face up off the carpet and pulled the fibers out of my skin and I said, I'll never do that again, and I did it anyway. That means when I would finally get all that stuff out of my system around 4 or 5 o'clock and it was pouring out of my pores from the night before, from 2 days before, 3 days before, and I could finally start thinking of it again. I don't know if you've ever had to experience that, but when you're so polluted that you can't think straight, and you're actually just working on autopilot, and you're going from appointment to appointment, and you're like, hello, yeah, yeah, and you're just praying for the day to be over, and you're just going from moment to moment to moment, and you don't know when it's going to end, and sweat's pouring out, and you have to change your shirt 4 times a day. I don't know if anybody's ever experienced anything like that. And then finally, so about 6 or 7 o'clock at night, my head starts to clear and I change my shirt for the last time. And I say to myself, I'm not going to do this again. And by 11 o'clock at night, I'm doing the same thing. That's what you call slavery. So when Jerry said to me, you're going to get down on your knees in the morning and you're going to ask God to keep you clean and sober. And at night, you're going to thank him. Do you think you could do that? And I knew I didn't want to become a slave again because I was 30 days clean and sober. And I said, I'll do it. And then I told you guys a story last week of when I went to the Sprint store and I said to the guy behind the counter, I need to have the cheapest cell phone in the place. And the guy behind the counter says to me, Stevie B, it's so good to see you from Victory. Welcome back. And so my best intentions was to go out and use one more time. My best intentions was to go out and get drunk one more time. And God's idea was different. But because God's a gentleman and he doesn't just like shove you out of there, he just walks in your way and he hopes that you take the... He sends a guy in my path to say to me, Stevie B, it's good to see you back. Instead of selling me a cell phone that I was going to go use the money, my wife put $197 on my card and I was going to use $193 of it to get drunk. I was looking for a $4 cell phone. By the grace of God, they didn't have any $4 cell phones. And the guy behind the counter happened to be a member of Victory. And I leave that appointment, and that's where I left you guys last week. And I leave that appointment, and I walk outside, and I'm 30 days sober, and I go back to the house, and I don't have to lie to Eddie and Mason when they come home. And I start going to meetings, and this is going to upset some of you, but this is my story. This is my story. You understand that God knows exactly what we need in our stories, and he knew what I needed. And I'm still burping up rocks from the month before, and I'm still, you know, I still have vodka coming out of my shirts, and I smell like day-old potato vodka, and I say to my dad, because I had just gotten 6 felonies from driving under the influence, and I say to my dad, who's sitting right over there, just a sweetheart of a man, incredible man in my life, I say to him, I want to go down to this speaker in Miami, West Dixie meeting, it was called, and I can't drive. Would you drive me there? And he takes me down to hear Russell share. And I'm in the room and I might not even been sober 30 days, Eddie. I might not have been sober 30. I might have been sober 2 weeks. Because I remember still thinking about on the way down, if I ran fast enough when my dad wasn't looking, you know, maybe because it was like on Dixie and it was in Miami and I could smell that there was bad stuff in the area. So I might not have been 30 days because I remember I was like sniffing like a dog. I'm like, I know there's bad stuff in the area. So I don't know how sober I was or not sober, but I know that I was thinking about other things. And then Russell does something in the meeting, and I'm gonna say the word Bible, okay? So don't have a nervous breakdown. I already said it, okay? Nobody got drunk, and okay, two people got drunk, but besides that, everybody's okay. And Russell does something that I know, James, is not AA approved. I could just tell this is not AA approved. Because I was in AA for 7 years, and I never seen anything like this. And I don't really know who Russell is at the time, but he opens up the Bible in AA. Now, I know this ain't going to fly. Now, I'm sober like an hour, but I say to my dad, oh, Dad, they can't do this in AA. You know, this is bad. This is real bad. And so my dad's like, sheesh, he does it. It's going to be fine. My dad's sober like 10 years at the time. And he had 10 years in GA at the time. Now he's got 19 years. And I know that you can't do that. Now, I don't know exactly where the rule is, but I know it's a serious rule that if you bring that out, it's going to be serious consequences. Okay? And I have a feeling they're not going to invite this guy back because I know this is not good. So he opens up the Bible and he reads something from the Bible. Now, I don't know what he read. It could have been a nursery rhyme for all I know. I have no idea what he read. I have no idea. I mean, I never heard Bible in AA. I never heard, you know, I never nothing. Now, God knew what I needed that night. And it was a seed that was planted in my heart that, listen what it was. The seed wasn't that I needed to rush out of AA and go get a Bible. It was that maybe there was more that I could be doing than just hanging on in meetings. Maybe there was more to my spiritual program than doing anything that I wanted inside out of AA and acting like a saint in AA and a complete jerk outside the rooms of AA. Maybe there was more to that. Maybe that's why I relapsed. Maybe the conversation that I was having that you can do anything you want as long as you stay sober, maybe that was the wrong conversation I was having with myself. Maybe the idea that for the 6 years that I was acting like I respected the sisters and the girls in AA but disrespecting them in the parking lot with other guys, maybe that wasn't the way that the principles in all my affairs. Maybe doing things on the side and not paying all my taxes and doing things that I wouldn't really respect other people doing, maybe that's not the way you do it. Here this guy is in AA, and the thing that I've been hearing for the last 10 years in AA since I came in is that as long as you stay sober, and at least this is what I heard. I'm not saying that this is what you guys said. I heard as long as you stay sober, you pretty much could do what you wanted. And the guys that I hung out with at the time, that's the way they acted. Because as soon as they were out of a meeting, they would say stuff like, you want to go to the casino, you want to go to Tootsie's. Like, I didn't think there was any meetings going on in the back of Tootsie's, so what would I be doing in Tootsie's? I don't think there was any service work going on over there. You know, and also, what was I doing hanging out in meetings and then going hanging out in the casino for all hours of the night? Was that how I was being of maximum service to God in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous? Is that why I couldn't work the phones? Because I needed to go over to those type of places? And then Russell said something in the Bible. I don't know what he read. But for the first time, a light went off in my mind, and I realized there might be more to this God thing than I knew about. And maybe this guy that thought he had all the answers, New York, Long Island, Italian Guinea, I had calamari for earrings and the whole nine yards. Maybe I didn't have all the answers. Maybe that's why I had 30 days again. Maybe that's why, after not having my drug of choice in my system for 7 years, that I couldn't stay sober. Maybe I needed to try something different. Maybe I needed to find a new path. And I came home that night, and my dad dropped me off with Eddie Mason. I said, listen, I was at a meeting in Miami that was unbelievable. They looked at me like, you're lying. You weren't in a meeting in Miami. You know, I was like, no, I went all the way down to Miami to hear this speaker. And they were looking at me like, you didn't go to a meeting in Miami. And I started on a path that was different than ever before. I started to understand that when they talked about making a decision to turn our life and our will over to the care of God, that it has a lot more to do than what they say in the meetings. Like, there's three frogs. They sit on a log. One of them makes a decision to jump. How many frogs are on a log? Yeah, but that has nothing to do with the third step. That's a nice rhyme. That's a nice riddle. But that's what I was following for 6 years. Well, I don't really need to make a decision. I don't really need to do anything in the third step because there's three frogs. One of them makes a decision. How many are still there? And I was living that life. I was living on the, I just made a decision in the third step. Well, making a decision in the third step is a lot more than making a decision. It's like making a decision like this. Like the plane's going down at 50,000 feet, and here's your decision. You want to take a life vest, or you don't want to take a life vest. That's the type of make a decision it is. It's not three frowns and a log, one of them drums. That's not what it was. It was, this is your life. This is your life. I don't care what anyone else thinks about your life. It's your life. This is not a dress rehearsal. I heard those things going off in my head, and I realized that's all the life I was getting. I was 34 years old. I'm back in a halfway house church around the corner from here. My wife's living in the house down the street. I got one pair of shoes, and I got a Winn-Dixie bag. How did I wind up in this place? I mean, I'm a nice, like, half-Jewish, half-Italian kid from Long Island. I'm walking around with a Winn-Dixie bag. And I realized that making a decision to turn my life and my will over to the care of God was not such a hard step to make. Because I looked over the room at my life and my will. I was sleeping with another man in another bed in a halfway house in a little tiny mattress that wasn't really even a mattress. Jimmy has a halfway house with his mattresses, and so does the Cleveland house. But my place where I lived back in the day, they had like cots. Okay, it's like a green thing that wanted to be a mattress but could never graduate to a mattress. And I'm looking around the room and I'm saying, this is my life and my will. You're asking me to surrender this? And then I backtracked just for a second and I looked over the second step and where it says, made that came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And in my life, on that second step, I stood on, restore me to sanity or restore me to a sanity that I never had before. And for me, that's where it was. I didn't want my old life back. I wanted a new life. And I found out in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says a new life. That you'll be given a new life. And to me, that was very reassuring because I didn't want my old life. Having back my old life would have been like taking a shower and putting back dirty sneakers and dirty shoes and socks. I didn't want an old life. I wanted to be clean, I wanted to move on, and I wanted a new life. You hear the thing where they talk about a life beyond your wildest dreams? That's not for people that take half measures. That's for people that make a decision to turn their life and their will over to the care of God. And then my sponsor said to me, I want you to memorize the third step prayer. And I thought that was drastic. I thought that was drastic. I mean, it says in here, you don't have to say it perfectly. And I stood on that for 6 years. It says it, the words were not that important. So anytime someone said to me, we recommend that you memorize the third step prayer, I was like, yeah, but in there it says that the words are not important. Yeah, but some of the words are. Not memorizing the third step prayer is not the same as you don't have to get it perfect. I was always shooting for the low rung. I was always shooting for progress, not perfection. Anytime I ever had to do any work and I didn't do it, I was like, well, it's progress, not perfection, isn't it? Do you ever notice that that is the enemy of excellence in the program? That's an enemy of excellence. Well, we start using that as our mantra. Our mantra, listen, if your mantra is progress, not perfection, you need to get a new mantra. That's a terrible mantra. They put that in there in How It Works so when you go into treatment centers, people don't get overwhelmed. Not so you live by it and put it on your window. Progress, not perfection. That shouldn't be your mantra. It's okay to shoot for perfection. It's okay to want to be perfect and then know that you're never going to attain it. But I was shooting for all those years like, well, I'm sober. You know, I remember in my fourth year of sobriety, I was arrested for making fake IDs at the swap shop. It's nice that you're enjoying that. It's nice. That's nice. So I'm in the jail. You know, I'm in jail. They come to my business. They arrest me. I'm in cuffs. I go to jail. Sober. You know, not for some outstanding warrant that I'm cleaning up. You know, people go to jail sober when they're cleaning up the wreckage of their past. I was creating wreckage in my present. I was like one of those guys that had the, you know, those. I think they call it curling. They have the thing on the ice and they sweep real fast and the thing comes by and they're sweeping real fast and the faster they sweep it, the longer that curling thing goes. My life was a bunch of records and I was walking around going like this. in sobriety. I'm sweeping all over the place. I'm wondering why I'm always exhausted. It says on page 86, 87, and 88 that we're not going to tire so easily. Tim Stack, I don't know where he is tonight. Tim went to a meeting in the morning, called me in the morning, prayer in the morning, worked all day, met with guys, went to our event that we had tonight, and drove up to Sample to pick two guys up, came back down here. He's wide awake in the meeting because we don't tire so easily. We're not thinking about our own little plans and our designs. We're thinking about what we can pack into the stream of life, how we can be of service. And when I called him tonight after he'd done all that stuff, and I was like, Tim, can you go to Sample and pick up two guys? To me, Sample seems far. You know, I mean, from here, Sample seems like, you know, Zimbabwe. I mean, it seemed real far. I'm like, can you just get up and get out and drive to Sample to pick up two guys in a, I don't know if you guys are in a halfway house or what are you doing, but he says to me, it's Sample, Steve. And I go, and he goes, but of course, because we don't know where our next miracle is going to happen if we're open to the next miracle. Amen. He doesn't know if the miracle is going to happen on the way up to Sample. He doesn't know if the guys that he's going to pick up are going to be the next phase of his life that's going to be unbelievable. But if you have that open-mindedness, if you have that willingness, yes, Sample doesn't seem like a far distance. And that's the type of excitement. Those are the type of people that I love to be around. Eddie comes here from Del Rey. And he's 32 years sober. And I say, Eddie, you want to go do this thing? And he's like, yeah. I'm like, you want to go hear the speaker in Miami? He's like, yeah. I love that. When it says that half measures availed us nothing, it really means that it avails us nothing. It means that old ideas need to be exchanged for new. Whatever you came in here tonight, I know the moment I mentioned the word Bible, I understand the big book says that we're going to bristle with antagonism. With the mere mention of religion, we're going to bristle with antagonism. With just the mere mention of it, because we've been shoved down it in our whole lives. And yet, people didn't run out screaming. Nobody left it in hysterics. That's that type of open-mindedness, and I'm not saying towards the Bible, but towards any ideas. I remember one time that, no, I can't get into that story, that's too long. So, I'm driving out of Miami. I called Russell the next day from a Barnes & Noble's. I say, Russell, this is the guy last night that was with his dad. I said to my dad, wouldn't it be amazing if I could get that guy as my sponsor? That's probably the problem. You know, and I had an amazing sponsor, Myron, that you guys know from the 12th. He's an incredible sponsor. But I needed to change everything this time. I needed to change everything. So I said to my dad, you know, one of the reasons I can't stay sober is because I don't have that guy as my sponsor. And so Russell's walking out, as Russell does, and he's like, hey, kid, how you doing? I'm like, can I get your phone number? I wanted to show my dad. They said, you don't just go up to the speaker and ask him for the phone number and he gives you the phone number. I'm like, can I get your phone number? He's like, sure. See? I call him the next day. I'm like, I'm the kid that asked you to get your phone number at the end of the night. I say, hey, how you doing? He said, I'm sitting here with some friends. I said, I'm in a Barnes & Noble. I'd like to buy a Bible. Because I didn't even know where they sold Bibles, to be honest with you. The only Bibles I had ever seen were in hotel rooms. Now, when I was a kid, we had Bibles in the house. But there was a long time from the time I'm 12 to the time I'm 32. And the only time I seen Bibles was in hotel rooms, and I was always putting stuff in there so people wouldn't find it. So I didn't even really know where they sold Bibles. But the point is that the next day I was willing to do something different, is my point. And then I started traveling down to Miami, and I started listening to different speaker meetings. I started doing different things. And then he said to me at 6 months of sobriety, I want you to come out to California. And at that time, I was being sponsored by two guys. I was being sponsored by Jerry and Russell. And he said, Jerry said, I want you to come out and do your fifth step with me. Now, I had always done fifth steps with local guys, like Joe Quater and those guys. Guys that kind of let me off the hook, and guys that when they heard my fifth step, that liked some of my stories, and usually afterwards we would do some of the behavior together. That's the type of guys I would pick. You know, guys always on the fringe. You know, I would always pick fringe guys. You know, guys that I knew that really didn't have like a real high moral compass, so they wouldn't judge you. You know what I mean? We never chose a guy that was actually flying straight. I wanted to choose a guy that, and it's not Joe Quater, I'm talking about other guys. I would choose a guy that maybe that I knew was not being faithful to his wife in every way. So I'm like, would you hear my fifth step? You know, not like a priest or a rabbi. I choose like a degenerate, you know. I'm like, hey, would you hear my fifth step? Because that guy's not going to judge you. You know what I mean? He's slithering up to the podium. And those are the guys I would do fifth steps with. But this time around, I had a sponsor out in the West Coast, Jerry Baer. And he taught in Yeshiva, which is a Jewish school. And I knew that this guy had a high moral compass. And he wasn't going to be okay with the stuff that I was going to be telling him. He was going to be okay with it in terms of the fourth step type of behavior, but he wasn't going to be okay with it like, yeah, Steve, keep doing it. Yeah, well, that's awesome. That's great. That's great. Yeah, keep that secret video collection while you're married. Yeah, that's good. That'll be good for your marriage. Those are the guys that I went to. So Jerry says to me, I want you to fly out to California to do the fifth step with me. Now, that seemed, now let me tell you right there, my wife will tell you, that seemed extreme. To fly out to California, I figured I would email it to him. You know, check over the fourth step. Email it back. I mean, you're in San Francisco. Okay, I'm in a halfway house. It seemed like a long way to travel to tell a guy my deepest, darkest secrets. I figured I'd put it in some type of email with a filtering and you couldn't read it. He's like, I need you to fly out to San Francisco. And on the way there, my best friend in the program dies while I'm on the plane. So I call my wife. My wife's like, you got to speak to Mara. Danny died today. Danny goes in for a stomach surgery, 14 years clean and sober, and dies from the stomach surgery. I'm crushed. I'm in the plane. I'm in first class because one of the guys from our halfway house, his father worked for the airline, and he gave me tickets to go out there. And I'm sitting there, and the flight attendant gentleman comes over, and I'm crying. I'm totally crying. I'm totally caught off guard. I'm over there, and I'm writing my fourth step like a fiend because, you know, of course, I told my sponsor it was written months ago. You know, I don't even know if it was first class or last class, because I'm just writing away. And then the flight attendant comes over to me, and she said, and he says to me, are you okay? And I go, no, I'm not okay. And he says to me, would you like to have a drink? Now, at that moment, I thought to myself, I'm justified to have a drink. This is how alcoholism works. If you ask me if I want to have a drink right now, that'll sound like the most ridiculous, moronic, absolute no question in the world. But catch me when I'm a little bit off my game and you ask me if I want to have a drink and I'm in total sorrow or something horrible is going on or a broken shoelace or a death. Broken shoelace or a death. A lot of traffic on 95 or amputation. You know, something, it's right there. Everything with me is a drama. But at that moment, I just lost my best friend and he says to me, would you like to have a drink? But by then, I'm 6 months sober and I have a support network and I call Eddie and then I call Jerry and I call Russell. And all three said the same thing. You don't honor Danny's death by drinking. You honor Danny's death by showing up as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You go over to do your fifth step with your sponsor as you're supposed to. You do the work you need to do. You come back. I called Sandy. Sandy calls the wife. I said, listen, I can't come to the funeral. And everybody understood, because if I can't take care of myself, I can't show up for you. I can't be running around at 6 months of sobriety, leaving state to state to go to funerals. I needed to take care of myself at that moment. And I showed up like a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did the fifth step. My sponsor had me on my knees. We gave my defects of character as best as we could at that time. We showed some light on it, and I'm going to talk to you about that in weeks to come. But the reason I tell you that story tonight is because a lot of stuff happened in my first year. Is it painfully hot in here right now? Is it painfully hot? I feel like there's something going on in here, like a thermonuclear explosion inside my body. No, nobody else is going through that. I mean, it's like hell hot in here, you know what I'm saying? The week after that, I'm back here in Florida. And the prize of my life, the woman, you know, there's my mom, my grandmother, my wife. The trifecta in my life. That's the trifecta right there. And I always said that there's no way I'm going to be able to stay sober if my grandmother dies. During my first 2 years of life, my mother went through a lot of things. She was becoming a doctor. She had a lot of tragedies going on in her life. And my grandmother helped me raise me. I'm sure there's a lot of people in here that when you say grandma, everything wells up inside you. Grandmas have this amazing abundance of love for us that nobody else can touch. And she passes away when I was 6 months sober. And I'm able to fly to New York as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, with a person that has a God in my life, a person that made a decision to turn my life and my will over to the care of God, and I'm able to be there with my family, not creating more drama for them, but trying to be of service the best that I can with 6 months of sobriety. And I return back to Florida, and I'm still living in a halfway house. But I'm doing stuff like in the morning, I'm like now doing prayers from like the 24-hour day book. Because if this is the last meeting that we're together, I don't want to, and I know the meeting has to end, I want you to hear this. This is so important during this holiday. On page 86 of the big book, big book Jeff will tell you, this is the deal right here. On awakening, let us think about the 24-hour day ahead. We consider our plans for the day. Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that it be divorced of self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. And in the morning, I was starting to check in with God, and I was starting to go over my day with Him, and I was starting to almost believe in Him. And things were starting to happen in my life. And my wife and I were getting along, and we were going to meetings together, and we were going to church together, and I was life was starting to happen around me. And then in 9 months of sobriety, I got to leave these guys, which was a glorious day. My wife invited me to come back and live in her house, in our house. You see, I'm even saying 9 years later, her house already. I still can't get over that. She asked me to come back and live in our house, which I had signed over, you know. I don't know if you ever told you that story, that my parents went with my wife and got divorce papers signed against me. My parents went with my wife against me. That's bad when your own parents are going with your wife to get stuff against you. You know what I'm saying? Todd, that's not good. Keep that in your mind, okay? That's not good. And she invites me to go back and live in the house. And she gives me a key. James, check this out. For 9 months, she's allowing me to visit when she tells me you can visit. But she only gave me one key. But there's two keys in the door at my house. And she would always say to me, you can use the, here's the key for the top lock. And someday you're going to have both keys. And I would think that would be the most amazing thing, that someday I would have both keys. And when she allowed me to come back in the house, she only gave me one key. And I said, what about the key for the other lock? She said, they were always the same key all the 9 months. That shows you what a brain surgeon I am. I never could put it together. It was the same key. So she gives me the key. Well, I'm in the big bed. My wife is downstairs. She's brewing coffee. She's cooking eggs. I don't know. I think there was birds chirping in the back. You know, kumbaya I was going. It was an amazing morning. I'm out of the halfway house. And I decide that morning that I'm going to turn the mattress over because my side of the bed is lumpy. My wife is only 90 pounds and hers was very nice. And I decided I was going to turn the mattress over. I got up off my knees. I said, God, thank you for returning me back to this house. And I turned over the mattress, and there was my stash from 9 months ago that I had hid in a blackout. And I'm looking at my stash, and I don't know if you know this, but there's going to come a time in your sobriety when you're going to find out if you're the real deal or if you're full of it. You're going to find out if you're faking it or you're for real. No one else is around, and you live in integrity because it's what you do. And I'm looking at the stash, and I just know that this is not good. But I had just gotten off my knees. And I start crying, and I call my wife, and she comes up, and she's crying. There was never a time in my life that I've ever saw my drug of choice or my drink of choice that I didn't drink it or use it. But for the first time in my life, I actually had a working, almost understanding of what God was in my life. And it wasn't Steve and the drugs. It was Steve, God, and the drugs. And with God, I'm always in a majority. And He gave me the strength to pick it up, to flush it down the toilet. And I got to tell you, there's nothing more important than this holiday than having a relationship with God staying sober, because next week I'm going to tell you the rest of the story. Merry Christmas.